Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. This evening's guest features Sir Ken Robinson, a writer, a researcher, teacher, and speaker. We are thrilled that you are here. I warned Sir Ken in the back that I was going to try and not cry, and I think it was hard for me to even say thrilled. I promise I will not cry, but I am especially honored tonight. As our guest, I'm also a teacher. I co-founded 826 Valencia, and I co-authored Teachers Have It Easy. I produced a film about American public school teachers and how our society undervalues their central role to our country's well-being. I am truly honored to have the opportunity to be here. Let me tell you about Sir Ken Robinson. Sir Ken Robinson is probably most well known for his 2006 TED Talk, where he wanted to alert the world about why our current education system is failing our children. It's been seen 25 million times by an estimated 250 million people in over 150 countries. He is the Mick Jagger of TED Talks with his wry charm and hilarious timing, he unfolds his very serious mission. As he describes it, he hopes to transform the culture of education and organizations with a richer conception of human creativity and intelligence. Sir Ken Robinson is part of many projects and initiatives around the world with national and local education systems, as well as with corporate, cultural, and community organizations. That effort has led him to write several books about innovation and creativity, including his latest book called Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. Sir Ken believes that if people know and work to their strengths, that will transform the future economy. Sir Ken Robinson was born in Liverpool, England, where so many rock stars are born. He was a professor of education at the University of Warwick. He has earned many awards and honorary degrees, and in 2003, he received a knighthood from Queen Elizabeth II for his services to the arts. As I was preparing this discussion, I would mention your name to people, and every single person's eyes would light up. So San Francisco welcomes you. We love you. We so appreciate your point of view. So ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome Sir Ken Robinson.
Oh, thank you. So, no pressure then, that's the thing. Well, thank you, Nineveh. It's a fantastic introduction. And all true. That's the beauty of it, really. It is true. I was born in Liverpool in 1950. And I now live in Los Angeles. We moved there about 12 years ago. And this book I published a couple of years ago is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. One of the people I interviewed for it was Paul McCartney, the bass guitarist of the popular music group, The Beatles. I tell you that because I wouldn't like you to leave this evening without being aware of the fact that I hang out with Paul McCartney. I think it's very important you understand that. But I asked him if he'd enjoyed music at school, and he said he didn't enjoy it at all. I said, did anybody think you had any talent at school? He said, no, nobody thought I had any particular talent at school in music. He does, doesn't he? Don't you feel? One of the other people in the same music program was George Harrison, the lead guitarist of the popular music group, The Beatles. And nobody thought he had any talent either in music. So I said to Paul McCartney, would this be a fair summary that there was this one music teacher in Liverpool in the 1950s who had half the Beatles in his class and he missed it? He said, that's right. Well, it's a bit of an oversight, isn't it? My wife is a major fan of Elvis Presley. Terry and I have been together now for 37 years. Can you blame her? I think not. But she's a big fan of Elvis. There are, in fact, three of us in this marriage. Fortunately, I'm alive. But it's... it's a marginal advantage, to be honest. I mean, the 37 years, the same look of disappointment at breakfast. It wears you down, you know. Plus, the wig itches. I'm just saying. Elvis Presley wasn't allowed in the Glee Club at school in Tupelo, Mississippi. They said he would ruin their sound. Elvis. Well, we all know what great heights the Glee Club went on to, you know, once they'd managed to keep Elvis out of the picture. You see, this is partly my point, that human talent is highly diverse, very rich, and often hidden. It's often buried beneath the surface. And one of the consequences of this is that very many people go through their entire lives without ever discovering what they're good at, what their real talents are. And the consequence of that is that very many people think they don't have any talents at all. No special talents to speak of. And the consequence of that is that many people go through their whole lives just trying to get to the weekend. You know, they don't enjoy their lives. They, so to speak, they endure them. They put up with them. And I feel it's a tragedy that this should happen. I did an event recently in Vancouver. Actually, it was 2 years ago now. Well, 2.5. Do you care when it was? Does it matter? I can find out. Now, I did this event in Vancouver. It was a peace summit. It was called the Vancouver Peace Summit, as it turns out. The Canadians are very good with titles, I find. I was moderating the opening session of this thing, and the guest of honor on the platform, there were 2,000 people in the room. The guest of honor for this panel, there were 8 of us on the panel. The guest of honor was the Dalai Lama. He was a remarkable and wonderful man. And he said lots of very interesting things, as you'd imagine. He was asked a question at one point, and there was a long silence in the room as he pondered on it. And it was like a minute long, probably, which is a long time, isn't it, when you're waiting for a thought to be formed with 2,000 people. And we all kind of metaphorically leant forward as he framed this response. And then he took a breath, and we thought, here it is, here it is. And he said, I don't know. We thought, what do you mean you don't know? You're the Dalai Lama. You know, we don't know, you know, but you're the Dalai Lama. And he said, you know, I'd never thought of that. I don't know. I'd never thought about that. What do you think? I thought that was a great response from one of the world's great teachers. I have no idea. Teach me. Tell me what you think. By the way, Nineveh's introduction was wonderful. I had to introduce the Dalai Lama. I was a bit concerned about how to do it, frankly. You know, because he's an amazing man in himself, but he's also the 14th. So there are another 13 you've got to take into account, you know, when you're introducing him. You just had to worry about me. And then I thought, I really don't need to introduce him at all, really, because if your name starts with the, I think you've arrived socially, haven't you, really? If you've managed to collect the definite article somewhere along the way, I think you can relax in most settings at this point. Like, which Dalai Lama are you? That would be thee. Anyway, one of the other things he said was this. He said, to be born at all is a miracle. So what are you going to do with your life? And I really thought that was an important and simple statement, because it is the case, to be born at all is a miracle. It was calculated recently, I won't take you through the whole process of asking the question, but it's a question worth asking yourself about how many human beings do you think have ever lived on Earth? How many of us? And, you know, modern human beings are thought to have evolved, behaviorally at any rate, about 150,000 years ago. I know there are some people who think it all happened in the last 2 weeks, but I'm discarding this alternative view. You know, I think we've been around longer, maybe 150,000 years. So I'm not talking about prehistoric creatures that went round on their knuckles. I'm talking about groovy people, you know, like us, you know, with attractive profiles and, you know, and a sense of irony. The best calculation if you Google the question, the best calculation people come up with is that maybe 100 billion people have lived on Earth. A couple of interesting things to say about this. The first is, of that total number, almost 10% are on the planet now. It's actually just over 7%. There are 7.2 billion people on the Earth. We're heading for 9 billion by the middle of the century, maybe 11 billion by the end of it. That's more people than have ever been on the planet at the same time in the history of humanity. And we don't know, honestly, if we can cope with it. There was a very interesting program on the BBC about how many people can live on Earth. It was called How Many People Can Live on Earth? And it was a Canadian producer, I think. But they made this calculation. I mean, you can watch the program yourself. You can download it. But they made this calculation that if everybody on Earth consumed, you know, food, fuel, water, in the way we do now, at the same rate and by the same means of production, if everybody on Earth consumed at the same rate as the average person in Rwanda or India, the Earth could sustain a maximum population of about 15 billion people. So we're halfway there for the first time in history. The trouble, of course, is that we don't all consume as they do in Rwanda and India. So they said if everybody on the Earth consumed at the same rate as the average person in North America, that's us, the Earth could sustain a maximum population of 1.5 billion. And we're four times past that already. So if the whole planet wanted to live as we do here, and they do, incidentally, all the evidence from the emerging economies is they rather like what we've been up to. I mean, they're not suggesting they'll hold back, you know, in the common interest. Say, well, look, you had a great time. We'll forego it for the time being. You know, but could you send us the photographs because it looked terrific? They want the same thing. Well, if they were to want that, if we were to carry on as we do now, we would need four more planets by the middle of the century to make it feasible. Well, we don't have them. I want to come back to that, but the real point I want to get to just here is that of those 100 billion people who've ever lived on the Earth, nobody has ever lived your life. Each of you, all of us, your children, your grandchildren, everyone you know, is a unique moment in the whole of history. There's nobody ever been like you. I don't mean nobody ever resembled you. I mean, I'm like my father. It's one of the curious things, isn't it, about as you get older, you start to resemble your parents. I don't mean just physically, but you start saying things they used to say to you with deep disapproval. And you start repeating them, you know, in favorable terms to your own children. I'm a lot like my dad in lots. I'm also a lot like my mother. You know, I'm not prepared to go into it right now, you know, but, you know, but I am. But I'm not a clone. I'm similar to them. But here's the thing. My brother John, I'm one of seven kids. My brother John is currently doing our family tree. It's not much of a tree, as it turns out. It's like a small shrub, really, with kind of odd fungus infection in the roots from what we can make out, which we're trying to eradicate at the moment. But John discovered something I thought very interesting, that our eight great-grandparents, my eight-great-grandparents, our collective eight-great-grandparents, were all born in Liverpool in the 19th century within 2 miles of each other. That's how they met. No, they bumped into each other in the street or in a pub or wherever it was, you know, at somebody's house. And by the way, that's how people did meet. And for most of human history, people didn't go anywhere. I mean, they might have gone in times of conflict or on behalf of, you know, if they became sailors or trade, but it was unusual for people to travel much further than where they lived. They lived near where they worked. And it's why communities were so intensely vernacular in a way that they're not just now. Anyway, that's how they met. Now, you can say, no, that's not how it worked. You know, this was a cosmic plan, to which I'm oblivious, you know, that the cosmos so arranged things that these eight soulmates convened at the same point in the space-time continuum, that they should procreate and continue the process that has led to the miracle that is me. It's a way of thinking about it. I don't think so, really. I just think they had lower standards then, frankly. I think people ran into each other in the street and thought, you'll do, you know. I can spend my life with you without being constantly embarrassed. This will be fine. You see, they didn't have TMZ did they? Or People magazine or Facebook. You know, they didn't know Charlize Theron was out there. You know, so they settled for what was available. But then, you know, eventually my grandparents were born, and then years later my parents were born in these separate families, and they ran into each other, and then there was that night in the pub, and here I am. You know, and it's a miracle. But I said, because the same is true of you too, according to what view you take of these things, but your own ancestry, your personal ancestry, weaves its way through the whole tapestry of humanity. And many of our lives have intersected at various points in the past, and that's true of your children too. But the odds of you being here are remarkably slim, and far more people didn't get here than did. Somebody once said, it's an old proverb, you know, that you should never regret growing old. It's a privilege denied to many. And I think that's right. But what amazes me is how little people settle for. You know, they kind of just get on and wait for the weekend. I think of this as the other climate crisis. You know, there is a crisis in the world's natural resources, and, you know, we're not here to discuss that, but I think it has to be a backdrop to any conversation about education, by the way. But there's a crisis in the world's human resources, too. And I'll give you some examples of it. In America, currently, and I said, by the way, I live here. I wish to make this clear. I haven't just popped over, you know, to have a quick shot at you. I live here now and have done for 12 years. But in America, for example, something approaching a third of all kids who start the ninth grade in high school do not graduate from the 12th grade. Now, it wouldn't be accurate to use the single term dropout for all of that. Some people walk away from it. Some people are bored with it. Some people decide it's not for them. There are family circumstances that may get in the way. They may have to go. There are all kinds of reasons. Every child, every student has a biography. Like you, they wake up and they have feelings and motivations and aspirations. Every single one of them is living a story. And they have a reason if they leave school. Just in the way that kids who stay on also have reasons. But either way, about 30% don't complete high school. That's a catastrophe, isn't it? Because, I mean, if you were running a business and you lost 30% of your customers a year, you'd start to wonder whether it was you, wouldn't you? Is it me? Is it something I'm doing? It would be wrong to say these kids are failing school. It'd be much more accurate to say school's failing them, I think. But I'm very keen to emphasize this. I don't say this in criticism of teachers or school principals or superintendents. I know wonderful people who work in schools against tremendous odds out of a passionate conviction that this is how they should spend their life. And they work intently and with the best intentions with a passion. I'm talking about the dominant culture, which affects the teachers as much as the students. And often the people who run the school districts as well. There's a kind of lock here into this culture of standardization. Can I ask you, how many of you have got children of your own? Okay, how about two or more children? Okay. And the rest of you have seen such children? Small people wandering around. If you've got two or more kids, I will make you a bet. And I'm confident I will win this bet. If you've got two or more children, I bet you they are completely different from each other, aren't they? You would never confuse them, would you? Like, which one are you? Remind me. You know, your mother and I are constantly getting mixed up about this. The reason is they're as unique as you are. Everybody's biography is different. A unique mix of talents, aspirations, motivations, feelings, dispositions, a unique mixture, every single human life. And the reason a lot of kids drop out is because the system isn't designed to cater to diversity, but to a certain idea of standardization. And it doesn't speak to them in that way. You know, years ago, when I was a student in my 20s, I was back in Liverpool, and I went round the slaughterhouse. I can't remember why now. Half my family is vegetarian, the other half, well, two of them are vegan, and I teeter on the edge of this all the time. But anyway, I don't know why at the time I went round the slaughterhouse. I think I was taking a girl out, you know. You know, I know how to treat a woman, you know. Come with me to the abattoir. It will amaze you. Anyway, this is a facility designed, you know, to systematically slaughter animals. And it does. It doesn't fail. I mean, very few of them get away. You know, it's not like some escape committee, you know, where people are writing folk songs about the near miss they had. But as I was coming out of it, there was a door at the end of the facility, and there was a sign on it that said, veterinarian. And I thought, it's a bit late, isn't it? A bit late. I thought, he must be one of the most depressed people in the area. Don't you think? Another day, you know, of abject failure at the slaughterhouse. And not a single one has recovered. And I... administering CPR. So I said to him, I said to the person showing me around, I said, why do you have a veterinarian at the slaughterhouse? He says, well, he comes in periodically to conduct occasional autopsies. I thought, well, he must have seen a pattern by now, surely. I mean, another 2,000 dead animals. There's something happening in here. You know, I insist on seeing what's going on in there. This isn't right. Now, what I'm saying is, and by the way, they're also appalling places, but the reason I'm telling you is, if you set up a facility to do something, don't be surprised if it does. If you set up a system of education predicated on standardization and conformity and compliance and a narrow curriculum that excludes people's talents and takes no account of their personal interests, don't be surprised if they get the message and leave it not feeling fulfilled. Now, I think it's not just a person issue. It is a big person issue. It's a big economic issue. We can't afford to squander talent like this. It's a major cultural issue. H.G. Wells once said, quite rightly, that civilization is a race between education and catastrophe. And I think that's right. And we have an education system which is literally pointing in the wrong direction. So the book, The Element and Finding Your Element, are about trying to recover this idea of talent and diversity. So when I say there's another climate crisis, one of the examples is the way the school system works. The second is that more and more people are suffering from depression. The World Health Organization recently anticipated that by 2020, depression will be the second largest cause of mortality in human populations. It's a shocking figure, this, isn't it? Now, depression's a portmanteau term. I mean, it can range from anything from, you know, being mildly down to being bereaved, which is a proper response, to being clinically depressed. But these distinctions tend to be lost, I think, in the way drugs are being administered. For example, last year, the sales of antipsychotic drugs, we're told, for the first time in America, exceeded sales of drugs for acid reflux. That's an achievement in America, you know, to exceed sales of drugs for acid reflux. Now, people aren't born depressed. They become so for various reasons. And one of them, you know, is a lack of personal fulfillment in the lives that people lead. Gallup has just published a study that says that it's based on a national survey that 70% of adult Americans are disengaged at work, just not interested in it. You know, they're paying attention while you're there, but then they're back on Facebook. Now, I'm not saying that finding your element will solve all these social problems, but it would help. Now, being in your element is this to me. It's finding... there's a difference between sort of getting through the week and waking up wanting to get to it. You see, I also meet people who love what they do and couldn't imagine doing anything else. If you said, why don't you change track for a bit and try something else, they'd look at you as if you'd kind of gone mad and say, but you don't understand. This isn't what I do. This is who I am. You know, I love this. And I find that in every form of occupation or activity, if you can think of a human activity, somebody will love it and somebody else couldn't stand to do it for 5 minutes. I tweeted recently, you should know this. I'm in a post-tweet state, as you see me. I'm replete with tweets. And I was saying this recently, actually. 10 years ago, people didn't tweet, did they? I mean, people didn't tweet 10 years ago. I mean, if they did, they were discouraged, weren't they? People say, I'm sorry, what was that? Would you mind not doing that? This is people trying to ease in here. But I asked people to say if they could name a job that they would hate that other people love. And I got the normal run of things you expect, like proctologist. But people love that. They do. You wouldn't do it. I spoke recently at a conference of pathologists. They absolutely love what they do. They're highly talented, gifted, committed people. Somebody tweeted back saying, teaching, I couldn't bear to teach. And yet teachers love what they do, for the most part. If they don't, by the way, I suggest they do something else. Because I don't think you should waste your own time, let alone anybody else's. Being in your element is two things. It's finding things you're naturally good at, discovering your talents. And for the reasons I said at the beginning, they're often obscured. They're hard to find. You have to go looking for them and create the circumstances for them to show themselves. You know, if you've never picked up an instrument, how do you know if you could play it? If you've never worked in the outdoors, how do you know you wouldn't get on with that? If you've never sailed a boat, how would you know? If you've never worked in social care, how would you know if you had a gift for it or not? If you don't do things, you never really find out. We're all born with extraordinary latent talents, but they have to manifest themselves somehow. That's one of the problems with education. The curriculum becomes very narrow, and so people don't discover what they can do because of the lack of opportunity. But being in your element is more than being good at something. I know all kinds of people who are good at things that they don't really care for. They do it because they're good at it. To be in your element, you have to love it. If you love something you're good at, well, as I say, you never work again. I'll give a very quick example of this. I published a book years ago now in the 80s. And actually, I should just say in passing, I was at a university recently talking to some faculty, and somebody said to me, "You've been at this a long time now, haven't you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "What, 7 years? I said, "Why'd you say 7 years? He said, "You know, that TED Talk, that started it all, didn't it?" I said, "Yeah, but I was alive before that. You know, this is..." It was just a moment. You know, I've been on this beat for a while. Anyway, I published a book with others in 1982 on the arts in schools. Being your element is not just about the arts, but by the way, the effect of standardization and testing has been to cut arts programs across the country from schools. It's a catastrophe that we're doing that. We're depriving people of access to some of their most important talents and forms of understanding. But this, I say, it's not just about that, but it has implications for it. But I was talking to this woman who was editing this book I did called The Arts in Schools in the early 80s. And I said, I was having lunch with her. I said, "When did you get to be an editor?" And she said, "About 5 years. I was curious because she was a brilliant editor who had the temerity to correct some of the things I'd written. You know, so I was suppressing, you know, this kind of fervent rage against this woman at the time. Like, how dare you? I was trying to establish whether she was qualified to question me in this way. But no, she was brilliant. And I said, "How long have you been an editor?" She was about 38, 39. She said, "About 5 years. I said, "Really?" I said, "What were you doing before this?" She said, "I was a musician, a concert musician." I said, "Well, why did you change?" And she told me the story. She'd been a concert pianist, and she was giving a concert in London at the South Bank Centre. And at the end of it, she went out for dinner at the end of this week with the conductor to celebrate the week. And she said, "We got on really well." And the conductor said, "You know, you were brilliant this evening." And she said, "Well, thank you very much." And said, and there was this pause, and he said, "But you didn't enjoy it, did you?" She said, "How do you mean?" He said, "Well, playing, you were brilliant, but you didn't seem to me to be enjoying the performance." She said, "Well, no, not really." And he said, "Well, I mean, do you enjoy playing?" And she said, "No, not really, no." He said, "Well, why do you do it?" And she said, "I suppose because I'm good at it." And she said, "I thought about this," because he then said, "You know, being good at something isn't a good enough reason to spend your life doing it." And she said, "I thought about this and realized that what had happened was that she'd been born into a musical family. Her parents both played in an accomplished way. So she was introduced to music lessons. She learned the piano. She passed all the Guildhall exams. She went to a music school, the high school. Then she went on to the Royal College of Music, where she studied piano. And then she took a Doctor of Music degree. And she said, "As the night follows the day, I progressed onto the concert platform. And nobody, least of all me," she said, "stopped to ask if I really wanted to do that. It's just, everyone just took it for granted that I would." And she said, "I realized when I was speaking to her, I'd never really enjoyed it. I was just responding to other people's expectations of me." And she said, I knew that what I loved was books. She said, in every interval, in every performance, I was sitting reading books. I was making notes on books. I sought out the company of writers, of poets. I loved the literary world. I spent every spare minute I had in it. But I kept denying it to myself because I thought, this is just a hobby. what I'm meant to do is play the piano. And she said, at the end of that season, she closed the piano lid, and she said she never opened it again, and she's been immersed in books ever since. She said, and I've never been happier. Never poorer, but but never happier. And this is the point I want to make, really, is that we are born with these tremendous talents. We have to discover them. But our lives move in a different direction when we do. You know, life is not linear. That's one of the problems of the education system. Think of your own course in life. How many of you, can ask you, accurately predicted when you were at high school the life you've now gone on to lead? It's not very impressive, is it, really? You see, we subscribe to a myth that life is linear, and we believe in this when we come to write our resume. Because you have to set it out in two sides of paper, and you put certain headings in bold, you underline certain things, you put key dates, you miss out all the embarrassing stuff, you know, and you set it all out, and it all contributes to this impression of trying to give people of this well-ordered trajectory through life, fulfilling the strategy that you set out for yourself at school. Because what you really don't want to do is to convey to people the actual chaos you've been living through. You know, the constant process of innovation, improvisation, and opportunism or lack of it that makes up a human life. It's why everybody's resume is different. You don't get your resume with your birth certificate. You earn your resume. And assuming that life is linear is what's narrowed the school curriculum, and it's also led, I think, to a lot of people not discovering the way they ought perhaps best to be living their lives. So the element is about that. This new book, Finding Your Element, is a response to people asking me so often, well, how do I do that? How do I find it? And for a while, when the first book came out, I just kept saying, well, read it again. You know, it'll be fine. But there's a lot to say about it, and I hope we'll get to that in the conversation about just what's involved in making this practical move. But the principles are these, that life is not linear, life is inherently diverse, and life is creative. To be a human being is a creative process. If you're a human being, creativity comes with the kit. But you have to work on it. You have to evolve it. It's like people are born with a capacity for languages, but we don't all learn more than one. If we're immersed in lots of languages, we learn all of them. But if we don't get immersed in languages, we start to think we don't have much of a talent for it. But if the opportunities are right, then this starts to come to be. I mentioned just right at the outset here, Paul McCartney and George Harrison. Paul McCartney was saying that he and John Lennon, when they first got together, they only knew two chords. And then they learned, this in the late 50s, that there was this guy at the other side of Liverpool who knew a third chord. So they got on the bus and went to meet him. And they spent the afternoon and he taught them the third chord. I said, and then we went back and we kind of got on and started the Beatles at this point. What it also illustrates to me is that you can't plan your whole life out. You can only plan the next bit. You can just do the next thing and try and be true to your own inner sense of direction. And if you do that, you'll end up making a life. Education's not the whole story here, but it's part of it. But I think the issues here are global and urgent. We won't solve the larger questions that we face, the larger challenges we face in the world around us without looking at the world within us. There was a lovely book published, quite a good book. It's published in the 80s. It's not as good as my book. I wouldn't want to get carried away with it. It was a book called The Intelligence of Feeling. It starts off with an observation that we all live in two worlds. There's a world that exists whether or not we exist. It's a world that was there before you came into it. It's the world of history and events and circumstances and objects and other people. It's the world that was there whether or not you were there. The world that will continue to exist when you've left it. The external world, the world beyond your skin. But there's another world that exists only because you exist. A world that came into being when you did. The world of your private consciousness, the world of your private aspirations and hopes and anxieties. The world in which R.D. Lang once said, in which there's only one set of footprints. The world that kind of fades away from you when you fall asleep at night and revives when you wake up in the morning. The world through which you see the rest of the world. And what I'm arguing in Finding Your Element is that part of our responsibility to ourselves and our children is to engage with this outer world, to make sense of that. But we have an equal responsibility to engage with this inner world and try and understand the depth of resource that lie there as well. And I do think the path to the future here lies in understanding the relationships between these two worlds. But we can't understand the outer one until we make better sense of the inner one. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was very inspiring.
Thank you.
I'd love to also welcome Sir Ken's son, James, is here, and it's really incredibly exciting because I know many of you haven't had a chance to read the book, but I have, and I loved it, and I know you will too, but James collaborated with Sir Ken on the book. So my first question I wanted to ask you is what was that like, working with him, and what did you think of his contributions?
Well, I actually worked with James on the first book, The Element. He worked doing some research for me on that book, and he also drew a mind map that's in the book. I tried. I'm hopeless at this. This is all part of it, you see. I mean, there's certain things I'm good at and things I'm just terrible at. James and I actually went and took an aptitude test, because part of the argument in the book is you need to discover your own aptitudes. Aptitudes are the things that you're born with. Abilities are what you do with them. So a lot of our aptitudes are latent and never become abilities. They just sit there and we don't think much with them. It's like crude oil in the ground. But we went and took this test, and it was a very interesting one, actually. We took 2 3-hour sessions, and we had to assemble objects in 3 dimensions, and blocks of things. We had to do, we had to sequence these color tiles. We had to listen to musical tones. It was very interesting. My reservation about all these tests is they're helpful, but they're never definitive. No test you take is going to lead you to understand you should be playing the jazz violin. You know, that's something you have to find out for yourself. But it can give you some rough idea of your relative strengths and weaknesses. What was interesting was at the end of when we got our results from these 2 tests, it correctly said that I was much better at assembling things. I am. I quite like solving these sorts of puzzles, you know, these 3-dimensional blocks. James, after we tried the second one, nearly threw the whole thing out the window, you know, in frustration. He's much better at me at hearing songs and tones and identifying musical structures. We're both equally good on vocabulary, but it said I was exceptionally good at color and design, and recommended I should be an interior designer. When I told my wife that, she didn't stop laughing for the best part of 48 hours, because I'm absolutely hopeless on it. And the same test also said that James had a tremendous amount of what it calls foresight, a lot of ability to plan ahead. James almost didn't get this message because he was 20 minutes late for the briefing. I was saying before we came on, I'm thinking of writing a book called Waiting for James, which would be, it will be like Waiting for Godot, but less will happen. You know, that's so, but it was great. And actually, Kate, my daughter, worked with me on the second book. There's a lot of practical exercise in the second book, and Kate and I road tested all of them together. So I think it's very important to put your kids to work for free if you can do it. They owe you.
In the test, you talk about how humans, we change our self-perceptions because we want the answers to be correct.
Yes.
Tell us about that, because I laughed with that a lot.
There's something called, I think it's called the Forer effect. It was a study that was done years ago by a psychologist of that name. And it illustrates the fact that people are very keen to see themselves reflected. They want an explanation of themselves. So he did a test that's become very famous. He combined statements from astrological signs to produce a kind of generic statement about a paragraph long. And it said things like, you know, you're a person, you're a very independent person, but you also secretly depend on other people.
You haven't reached your potential.
You haven't reached your potential, yeah. That's right, yes. You benefit from other people's constructive help, but you're sensitive to criticism. Yeah. It kind of went on like this. You know, you have a great sense of the worth of other people, but sometimes feel you're not valued. So anyway, there's about a page of this stuff, and he gave this test to several hundred students, and he asked them to grade it on a scale of 1 to 4, according to how accurate it was, with 4 at the top. And the average score from all these students was about 4.8. They all said, I can't believe it, this is me. This is uncanny, it's like this person knew me personally. And the thing is, it's been repeated with thousands of people since. It's become a standard test, and it always comes up in the high 4s. It simply speaks to the fact that people are inclined towards these sorts of explanations. They want to believe it. It's like astrological signs. You know, you get, I mean, I'm a Pisces, which is a brilliant sign, by the way. I don't know.
Me too.
Are you right?
Yeah.
It's funny, my dad was a Virgo, and he thought all astrological signs were nonsense. Although he had actually quite a lot of the characteristics of Virgos, we're told. He's very methodical, very kind of pragmatic and efficient, hated people being late. And and didn't believe in all this stuff. And I used to really like winding him up by saying he wouldn't believe that because Virgos don't. You know, it's a characteristic of Virgos that he wouldn't think that. And so it's like that. You get these astrological, a short paragraph saying what's going to happen to you this month. And what people typically do is they believe the stuff that applies and they make allowance for the stuff that don't. So it ends up feeling persuasive. And I'm not trying to undermine all of that. I'm just saying that when you come to understand yourself, don't look for ready answers. It's like the Myers-Briggs tests, where you end up giving yourself four letters. You know what these tests are, don't you? It's interesting. Based on the work of Carl Jung, though he didn't produce these tests. That wasn't what he had in mind. But people come out and they'll give you these four letters and say, well, this is who I am. It's like it's their birthday. And I think you should just take it as information, but not be stereotyped. I think if we want to say there are this number of people in the world, types of people. I remember there was a sociologist I read once, we owe this to sociology, who said there were 12 types of people. I think there was a 13th discovered in Montana at one point. But my take on all that is, if there are 7.2 billion people in the world, that's how many types of people there are. Mm-hmm. And if this stuff helps you to understand more about yourself, fine. But take it with a pinch of salt.
Well, and I really enjoyed in your book, actually, that you go far beyond the personality tests. And there's a lot of different exercises, and I'll go right to it. But I would like to share with the audience that this is a Commonwealth Club event of California. And we are talking to Sir Ken Robinson about reforming education in his new book, Finding Your Element, about how to discover your true talents to live a better life. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online at Fora TV. I'm Nineveh Caligari, your moderator. I thought it was really fantastic, and it told me a lot that you started with meditation, and I thought that maybe you could lead the 500 guests in a meditation, but then I thought I would just let you off easy. Tell us why did you suggest that we start meditating? What is it doing for you?
Well, the premise of the book is that finding your element is, and I didn't invent this term. I mean, it's a common term we use, isn't it? When people are doing things they love to do, you say they're in their element. And you can tell when you are because your energy changes. I make a distinction in the book between physical energy and spiritual energy. I don't mean spiritual in the formal sense that you associate with organized religion. I mean in the sense in which you're in high spirits or low spirits, when you're feeling up and down. And we know that some activities energize us and some take it from us. People are the same, aren't they? You see some people coming towards you and your heart lifts and you think, oh, great, they're here. And then you see somebody else coming towards you and you think, really? Really?
No one here. Yeah. No one here.
Well, they're here, honestly. Can we reschedule? And they're not bad. It's just your energy just doesn't articulate. And I mean, when it really becomes synergistic, you're in love with somebody. It's Yeats said this. He talks about in one of his poems about two lovers having halved a soul. They felt they were, my wife Terry is a great scholar of Yeats, and I owe all this to her. I mean, she kind of led me to Yeats, like she did to Elvis, it turns out. But there's a difference between physical energy and spiritual energy. I don't mean they're separate, but they're distinguishable. And what I mean is, if you're doing things you love to do, you get energy from it. And at the end of a day, you might feel physically exhausted, but elated. It's just like wonderful. It was fantastic. I need to sleep, but it was fantastic. But if you do things you don't care for, you might be physically fine, but down. And there's no rule about how this will apply to any given individual. It differs for all of us, but it's a synergy between those two things. If you do something you love, an hour can feel like 5 minutes, can't it? If you do things you don't care for, 5 minutes feels like an hour. So part of what I encourage people to do in the book is to reflect on those things. There's a whole series of exercises around that to discover what it is that lifts you and what puts you down. It's different for everybody, although there are some patterns. But the real point I'm making is, when we think about these two worlds, is that finding your element is not a journey whose outcomes you can confidently predict. If you're traveling from San Francisco to New York, New York is there, and you'll know when you get there, and you can plan the journey. Finding your element's not quite like that, although it is a journey, it's a quest. A quest is a medieval term, actually from knighthood, as it turns out. Mm. But what it means is a journey you're undertaking without being sure of the outcome. You're looking for something, you're traveling hopefully and expectantly, But you may not be sure where to look yet, and you may not be entirely sure what it is you're looking for. But something's guiding you. It's what Joseph Campbell talks about in The Hero's Journey. And so it's a quest to find this. And I say in the book that it's not a 10-step program. Now, I can't guarantee by chapter 10 you'll be in your element. And the reason I can't is because it's your journey. And part of it is aptitude, part of it's passion, but a lot of it is also attitude. It depends how much you want this, what you're prepared to do, and how you're prepared to look at your own circumstances. But it's an inner journey, and it's also an outer journey. It's a journey inward to find out more about yourself, and it's a journey to find out more about the world around you. And I suggested meditating to the initial derision of my wife, because I'm not very good at meditating. I'm very honest about it in the book.
It's very funny to read. I can't wait for everybody to read it.
I wrote the first draft of this thing on meditation, and I showed it to Terry. I showed everything to Terry. We've worked together for 35 years. You know, she's great. And I showed her this, and she looked at me and said, "Are you serious?" I said, "What? What?" She said, "You're recommending people meditate." I said, "Yes," she said, "but you don't." I said, "What's that got to do with it?" I'm making a recommendation. Not saying I have to do it. No, but actually I have tried, and I do, as often as I can do this. But I don't mean it. I mean, some people are, James, for example, was a Buddhist at the age of 13 and studied Buddhism and actually took vows at a Buddhist monastery near where we live. And is very practiced at this. It's not an easy thing to meditate. If it were, you wouldn't have to practice it. But the reason I recommend it, and I'm honest about the difficulty, is because people do find it difficult, and so do I. But the reason I recommend it is that part of what you have to do is get to know yourself better. You have to spend a bit more time with yourself. And these days, there's so much clamor from the outside world, so much stuff coming at us. I feel it particularly for kids, you know, for teenagers. They're being besieged from every platform, you know, through text messages, through Facebook, through social media. They all have their benefits and advantages, but they're being pitched at constantly, you know, for their money, for their image, for their loyalties. And it's not surprising if they do end up feeling that they're unfamiliar with themselves. So part of it is you just need to get to know yourself a bit better. And one of the ways to do that is just to calm the world down and spend some time being yourself and listening to yourself. And I always say to them, if you're going to follow these exercises, if you can bear to do it, turn the gadgets off. You know, for half an hour, you know, the world will be there when you come back. But it's just one of the exercises, and I think it's an important one.
And there are many more. When I just read some research that said that people who meditate are healthier than people who exercise at the end of the day, and so I was excited about your first suggestion.
Yes, I wish I'd known that.
Yeah.
I think we're onto something earlier.
I would love to ask you a little bit more about your family. I was really touched by the story about your father's accident and your mother's response. Would you share that?
Yeah. Again, Terry suggested to me that I should tell my own story in the book. I mean, I was reluctant to do it, honestly, because I didn't think it was all that interesting.
I think it's so important.
Well, thank you. And she said, "No, you can't. You'll meet my wife at some point." You know, she's. But she kept saying to me, "You can't get other people to open up about themselves if you don't do it." And that's just commonly the case. You know, we had a headlock about that, and a day later I come back and said, "Of course, you're completely right." So we decided if we ever make a movie about our lives together. If anybody were ever to do it, there would be a continuous motif in the movie, which would be me saying today, "That is not going to happen. While there is breath in my body, this will not take place." And then we cut to the next scene where this very thing is happening.
Perfect.
So I said, "I'm not going to tell my story in the book." And the weekend I spent writing my story in the book. Because she's right. She's right. But I'll tell you what it was. I was born in 1950 in Liverpool. And until I was four... And I'm one of a big family. There are seven kids and nine of us all together. My mother was one of seven children. My dad was one of six. So we had relatives everywhere and big family parties. And until I was four, anyway, my dad, who was a soccer player and a sportsman, was telling everybody that I was going to be the soccer player in the family. We used to go to the local park and kick balls around the street. And I was fast and, you know, and tremendously attractive. You know.
He mentions that a lot, lot of his work. How good looking he is.
Tremendously attractive, really. It's frightening, actually.
Dashing.
Frightening. It's a burden.
It's obvious.
It's a burden.
It's obvious, no. But you mention it. It's very charming.
No, but I was a fit kid, and well built, like he was. And then, I mean, some of you remember this. In the 1950s, there were these polio epidemics that spread right across America and across Europe, and it was terrifying. Anyway, I got polio. So I was the only one in the street, and I went overnight, you know, from being a fit, agile four-year-old to being completely paralyzed. So I was in hospital for the best part of a year, about 8 months, and I came out, I was wearing two braces, I had crutches. This is what I was saying in the book. I had long, curly hair and a lisp. Come on. I mean, people spontaneously gave me money in the street. You know, I was... I was a poster child for cuteness, and actually my brother became my agent at a very early age, and I've yet to see any of the money, as it turns out. But you know, my parents, as you would be, as you're a kid, when you're a kid, you don't have any idea what your parents are going through. No idea until you become a parent. And it's that comment from Mark Twain. Do you remember Mark Twain said this? That until he was seven, he thought his father was wonderful and that he knew everything. He said, when I was 14, I was appalled at how stupid my father was. He said, then when I was 21, I couldn't believe how much he'd learnt in 7 years. I thought that was a great observation. You don't know what your parents go through. You don't know the pain of parenthood until you have children. But so I was in hospital. I came out, and my father and my mother were devastated, as you would well imagine. But they were fantastic. They didn't cuss at me. There's a big part of this for me. They didn't wrap me in cotton wool. I was still out playing in the streets with the other kids, and they all looked after me, I'm sure, but it wasn't obvious to me. I mean, I wasn't kept indoors, you know, like, be careful with Kenneth. They all called me Kenneth at home, by the way, and even now I associate being called Kenneth with disapproval, you know, so it's funny, isn't it, when people use your full name, you know you're in trouble. But here's the thing, this was Liverpool in 1950, it's high unemployment, my dad had been working, running pubs, there was no work in Liverpool, so he was finding jobs, you know, heavy manual work. He worked on the docks doing ship repair, which is heavy work. We had the big shipbuilding facilities in Liverpool at the time, Harland and Wolff and places like that. And then I was getting over the polio, at least I was getting around, and when I was nine, completely coincidentally, of course, my dad had an industrial accident at work. And this man who'd been so devastated by me being paralyzed broke his neck. At work, he was working as a rigger in a factory. They were fitting the whole workshop out, renewing the whole thing, and there was a large teak beam that was being hauled up into the workshop to prop up a boiler, and the rope snapped. He was standing underneath it, so the thing landed on his neck, and he was a quadriplegic for the rest of his life. So he never walked again. He was paralyzed from the neck down, with seven kids. And no income.
Did you say he was 45?
He was 45, yeah. 45. You see, I mean, I'm not being the old soldier about this. I mean, honestly, truthfully, if you're a kid and you get polio, it's just the reality. You just live with it. You know what I mean? It's not like I had a career skiing and I have to give it up. I mean, it's just, you know, you adapt to it. Mm-hmm. But for a man of 45 like that to become a quadriplegic with a family of seven kids is devastating. In every way, you know, because he couldn't do anything. My mother was absolutely fantastic. She always was, you know, she was an absolute inspiration. They both were, actually, to all of us. She was vivacious, she was funny, she had a constant appetite for new experiences, she was always onto something else. She was, we had no appliances in the house, she looked after nine of us, you know, with no washing machines or anything, really. I mean, I'd like to say we all gathered round and did our bit. But this was a long time before feminism, and we didn't really think it was necessary for us to lift a finger, frankly.
Because she handled it so well.
We all did muck in, truthfully. But she was just, I think, a model. I mean, the two of them remained devoted to each other. They were very funny. The house was just full of hysteria, in my experience, growing up with it all. I'm the quiet one in my family, I ought to say, by the way. So, you know, I just sit there making notes when they all get going. But what was also great was that my mum knew that it was, just intuitively, that it was important that my father retained his position, that they were kind of joint heads of the family. You know, so there was never some sense that we'll go and spend 10 minutes with the dad and keep him company. People sought him out because he was so funny and so present. So, yeah, I mean, you know, whenever I talk about my role models and anybody who met him, always consider him to be, you know, a prime example. And by the way, it wasn't some Pollyanna thing. For the first number of years, it was, you can imagine, an awful lot of people who suffer devastating paralysis lose the will to live, and some of them don't make it. And he stayed with it. He stayed with it, with her support. And we just went on, and he eventually got a very small amount of compensation from the company, which was, I think we worked it out, he got £18,000 in 1960, which would be $30,000. Even in today's money, it's what, I don't know, $300,000 or $400,000, nothing at all, really, for a man with a family of seven kids at the age of 45. But he just inspired everybody. He was great. And so what they then did with me was insist that I concentrated on my education. Because he was right about that. He said, you know, you're not going to make a living doing manual work. You've got to get educated. And neither of my parents were at school for long. They were both, I think, left at 14 or 15. But he insisted I did. And it was hard. I mean, I was a reluctant scholar. This was Liverpool. You know, I was 13 in 1963 when Love Me Do came out. My brothers were going down to the Cavern. And my brother Ian was in a rock band. They were practicing in the bedroom next to where I was trying to do my homework. You know, I didn't want to do this at all. But they just kept me at it and said, no, you've got to focus on your education. And to me, it was a very important lesson because it means, you know, I mean, if, it's the old thing. If one door closes, another one opens. We've all got options. You know, and I've always said this about my parents, that terrible things happen to everybody. You know, accidents happen, stuff happens. You have to deal with that. And I've seen you know, people go under rock for relatively small things happening to them. Attitude is everything here. It's not what happens to you that makes a difference in your life. It's what you make of what happens to you, how you decide you're going to deal with it. And I quote him because it was an example of a devastating accident, but it didn't destroy the family. It actually pulled us together.
It was really moving. I was going to ask you a question, and the answer, I'm going to give you the answer as well. The answer is 100%. So
good.
Two words.
Yes.
I was going to ask you, one of the things that's so inspiring in all of your work is your relationship with Terry and that incredible romance and work relationship that you have, your parents' romance and your mother's response to your father's accident is incredibly inspiring. I can't wait for everyone to read this in depth. So I was going to ask you specifically about women. What percentage of your success would you attribute to having strong, strong, fabulous, creative women around you?
Certainly in the high 90s, isn't it?
Okay. I'm going to stop being silly, but...
No, I'll tell you, Nina, seriously. Seriously? Probably all of it. You know, I mean, I've always been surrounded by strong, fantastic women. And men, I have to say, but women too. I mean, my mother was, you know, just a role model to all of us. But all her sisters were too. You know, they're very funny, strong, powerful women. And I think we just all grew up around it, really. We just kind of took it for granted. And I had great teachers at school. There was one woman in particular, Miss York, who was transformative in my life. I think it's fair to say, I mean, I hope it's true, I feel it's true. I don't think any of us in the family, my brothers and sister, we kind of made a distinction on those lines at all. You know, it's just like, who are you? Who are you? And it amazed me, actually, truthfully, when I left home and started to encounter other people's attitudes to women, I found it extraordinary. I don't know why they thought that way or how they got to think that way. And certainly in the part of Liverpool I grew up in, I mean, the women, including my mum, had tremendously hard lives to deal with, but they're always the first on the dance floor. You know, they're always there. You know, to enjoy what they had to do. And my mum, particularly, was always looking to the next thing. You know, that's what kept her alive. You know, she just kept looking for the next thing, and she was every day she was up and ready. You know, so yeah, and Terry, by the way, particularly, we've worked together, I say, for 37 years, and she's been my best friend and counselor and mentor all that time. I mean, I don't always take it kindly. You don't, do you? I mean, you often resist advice that you're given. But she's invariably right. I always come around to it.
Well, I enjoy...
and by the way, she's written her own book. She wrote a novel called India's Summer, which was came out, in a way, it turned out to be the novel of the element. We hadn't quite understood that. It's a really good book, and she's writing the sequel. So what we've also tried to, although we work together, we've tried to give each other space to do our own things, and I think that's equally important. That's what keeps you together. If you don't suffocate each other, you know, it's true though, isn't it? That, you know, you need to give people room to grow and to evolve. And I think we've always tried to do that.
In your work, you're so clearly pro-woman, pro-human. In your most recent book, you're, of course, looking for ways that people can find their own talents. But in your previous book, Out of Our Minds, you document human populations, the evolution of feminism, the evolution of writing, technology, for example, for people who haven't read it yet. He documents in an incredibly engaging way the process that the humans went through to get from the Gutenberg press to 3D printers. And in all of that, he talks about the process of the feminist movement, and he mentions that historically men had great ideas and women cared and wept. And you will laugh when you read more of his work. You will laugh and laugh and laugh. But one of the things that I thought was really powerful about Out of Our Minds is that your writing is engaging, but it's also optimistic. I'm worried about some of the progress. You mentioned the 9 billion people already, but robots with opinions, no privacy. There's all these things that we're moving towards so quickly together, and they are related to creativity and to progress, but it's, some of them intimidate me and give me pause, and I was wondering, in addition to the 9 billion that we're going to have soon, are there other areas that concern you?
Well, yeah. I mean, that does concern me a lot. I think that, I'm naturally optimistic about people. There was a British writer called Bernard Levin. Some of you may have heard of him. He was a writer for the Times. And his family were in the Holocaust. And he said, he's a brilliant writer. But I remember years ago I read this piece in the London Times where he said he'd been at this dinner and the question had come up whether people are naturally good or naturally bad. And he said he didn't hesitate to think they're naturally good. And he was astonished to find he was the only person at the table who said that. And that's not been my experience at all. I mean, terrible things happen. People are capable of terrible things. But in my experience of it, people are more inclined to do good to each other, to want to gather together and be supportive. You see that in times of tragedy, how quickly people gather. I think we've created conditions that are alienating for communities. When I talk about my great-great-grandparents, I mean, they were living in a completely different period where people didn't really wander more than three or four streets away, so they looked out for each other. When we grew up, nobody locked the doors, and people did look after each other's kids, and, you know, there was just an informal but strong sense of community. I'm not saying it was a Pollyanna thing. It wasn't the Waltons. We were living in difficult times, though we did live in a place called Walton, as it turns out, but I think that conditions become very alienating to people. And increasingly, I think there are levels of anxiety that are promoted by the incessant kind of news cycle. Again, you've got to be very careful not to be Luddite about this. I remember there was a very distinguished journalist in the UK called Richard Dimbleby, who'd be a bit like Walter Winchell, I guess. Richard Dimbleby, he used to commentate on all the great state occasions, you know, and he was the go-to person. He was the voice of authority. He started out in radio in the 1930s. He was a print journalist, but he heard that the BBC was planning to put out a news bulletin. There wasn't one at the time. So he showed up, and he said he remembered this bulletin. It was in the mid-1930s, and he said there was one scheduled for 1 o'clock. So he showed up at this studio. They said he could sit in. He said this man came to the microphone wearing a tuxedo. That's how they used to do it. On the radio, and because it was a formal thing, and this guy came with a very plummy English voice, and he said, I remember the entire news bulletin. He said, this is the BBC in London, it is 1 o'clock, there is no news. I thought that was great. It's like the whole thing, don't worry, there's nothing going on, you need to concern yourself with, just if anything happens we'll tell you. Now this was Europe in the mid-1930s. There was a lot going on. But the other side of it now is we have hundreds of channels, all of them fighting for your attention. And you know, if you watch the cable channels, no matter what happens, they get down to incessant, myopic, pointless detail, trying to keep your attention. And it does, I think, contribute to a kind of a general level of anxiety about things are all going wrong. And so I think my experience with it is people are naturally good, but there are all kinds of reasons to be anxious. These larger problems, though, I think depression has become such a big problem. But we do face massive challenges, and they're the result of human activity. And it's not the koala bears creating the problem, it's us. But I also believe that we have it within our power to tackle most of these problems if we really address ourselves to them. But it means a collective action. It means a real sense of social engagement. And it, above all, does mean thinking differently about ourselves and particularly how we educate our children. And I think if we could do anything collectively, we should start by trying to get a more generous sense of education, a greater emphasis on creativity, and a real orientation to our own possibilities and the genuine challenges in front of us.
What is your greatest hope? In your second TED Talk, you say that you're not excited about school reform, but a school revolution. What is your greatest, and a lot of the audience members are asking about questions, about your greatest passion, your greatest hope for schools and the perfect classroom, and whether you believe in the Montessori philosophy. Everyone wants to talk about schools, and I want to ask you, what does that revolution look like, ideally?
Well, I think it's based on two ideas, really. The first is personalizing, and the second is customizing. The analogy that works for me when you look at how education's developed, it's worth remembering that before the mid-19th century, we didn't have systems of mass education. I mean, people did get educated, but it was an elite activity. If you knew some Jesuits, you could probably pull it off. But interesting, in Britain, the interesting origin of this is that in the Renaissance period, there were schools that were available to the public if you could pay. And they became known as public schools because you could pay to go to them. Of course, in Britain, public means they're private. It's just important you know that because you can get very confused about this. But these mass systems of public education in America, for example, in the UK, paid for from taxation, compulsory, free to attend, They were quite new. They came about in the 19th century. And they came about because of the growing demands of the industrial economy, the great move from the countryside into the cities. And it's no coincidence that they were organized on factory lines. I mean, most schools were organized as if they were producing Model T Fords. They were organized for efficiency. You know, if you think of the way schools are still organized, we organize our children in schools by age groups. Why? It's got nothing to do with education, honestly. I know 8-year-olds who are very good at certain things that some 15-year-olds can't do, according to what activity we're talking about. Outside schools, we don't keep all the 5-year-olds in a separate facility, you know, away from the 7-year-olds in case they trip each other up. It's just it's something we do in school. Families learn across generations if they're encouraged to do it. We still, in high schools, divide the day into bites of time and ring bells, and people move around. We don't do that anywhere else. I mean, if you were running a business and you had 2,000 employees, and every 50 minutes a bell rang, and you all had to stop what you were doing, go to some other building and do something else for 50 minutes, and then rinse and repeat, you know, 8 times a day, you'd be out of business in a week. But we do it in schools, not because it's educational, but because it's modeled on this idea of industrial efficiency. And it's why I tell a story about the abattoir. You know, people scratch their heads and say, how can we solve the problems in education? And the truth is, we're creating most of these problems in the way we're organizing it. You know, if we didn't do that, we wouldn't have the problem. I was at the second TED, the third TED Talk I did, I was talking about alternative education programs. I went round some of these in Los Angeles recently. These are programs designed to get kids back into school who've fallen out of it for various reasons, and they have certain common characteristics. They're very personalized. That's to say, they address the interests and talents of the students individually. The staff are given strong support, and they're respected as professionals, which they should be. There's strong links with the community and flexibility in the way the day is organized, and they work. They get people re-engaged with education. What interests me is this is called alternative education. You know, if we all did that, we wouldn't need the alternative. And so part of what I want to say to schools is if we would solve a lot of these problems if we stopped causing them. You know, we're dealing with a problem that we're creating in the way we manage things. So I think we need a revolution in education in the sense that the old model is breaking down. I mean, if we had more time, there's lots we could say about this. But one of the things about it is that I think we've developed an obsession with everybody having to go to college. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying don't go to college, but there are many other ways of finding your way in your life, of doing things. I mean, there are vocational routes, there are applied routes, there are, you know, jobs that people want to get to right away. You don't have to go to college immediately. But the way things run just now, the whole implication is if you don't go to college, your life is finished. And it's not just going to college, it's going to certain colleges, and not just to those, but to do certain programs. So it's like this friend of mine who became the concert pianist because nobody could think of an alternative for it. I try and envisage a world that was run entirely by, if everybody in the world, you know, had a law degree from the Ivy League. I don't want to live in that
don't
world, do you,
it.
Really?
I'm
not against people having law degrees, but at the same time, there's a very narrow channel through which we push people. So I do think we need a revolution about this because all kinds of stuff to do with the way higher education is shaping up just now. But a revolution doesn't happen from the top. It always happens from the bottom. And what I'm always keen to say to teachers and to parents and head teachers is if you're in a classroom, if you run a school, for the students you deal with, you are the education system. You can't pass the buck here. It's you. And if you change your practice, when that door closes in your classroom, if you change things around, you're changing the world for those kids. If you're a head teacher and you change your school, you're changing the world for every kid who comes through it. And if enough people do that, that's a revolution. That's really where it has to start.
Can I ask you two more questions?
Yeah. I'm going to take two more questions, and then we'll sign books and talk some more, not on stage. Tell me, share the Venezuela story. What happened in Venezuela, and why was that so inspiring? Why do you talk about it so
well,
much?
Well, there's a system in Venezuela called El Sistema. You come across this. To me, it's a great example of the argument, or the point, that talents are often hidden. There's a wonderful man there called José Abreu. I think I'm pronouncing that properly. It's A-B-R-E-U, so correct me if you'd like. But is that right, Abreu? He devised a system of music education in Venezuela where there was no history of classical music, really, not even at the state level. It wasn't funded. He introduced a system of teaching young kids to play instruments in the classical repertory, violins, violas, you know, strings, wind instruments, and so on. These were kids, the programs were made available to kids in the slums of Venezuela. You know, in the favelas and the barrios, kids who came from low-income areas, high-crime areas. And he made available these instruments and a trained cohort of people to teach them. It started small. I think it's been going for over 20, maybe 30 years now. Mm-hmm. But it's grown rapidly. And now Venezuela has one of the most developed classical music cultures anywhere in the world. Thousands and hundreds of thousands of kids have passed through this system. With remarkable effects on the lives of individuals. It's transformed communities, it's heightened the expectations of the kids themselves, it's exposed them to talents they didn't know they had, it's created a sense of community where there often wasn't one. These are areas where, you know, they're laced with gun crime. It's produced a whole generation of distinguished musicians, including, for example, Gustavo Dudamel, who's the director of the LA Philharmonic, one of the most gifted young conductors in the world, has a strong association with Il Sistema. Now, this wasn't because José Abreu thought we should set up some scheme where we can audition kids and find out the ones who've got musical talent. They worked with anybody who came. And to me, it's like drilling down into the ground. There's all kinds of riches there if you just go looking for it. There's a case, for a school I used to know, did some work with in England in the 70s, the 1970s, that is. And there's a fantastic music dance teacher there called Nadine Senior. She taught contemporary dance. Again, it's a low-income school, high crime in that part of the city. Kids were mainly from, I think, Asian backgrounds, black families predominantly. It's a very, very mixed area ethnically and culturally. High unemployment, and it was a problem area. They hired her at this school to teach contemporary dance. And you can imagine, I mean, I have a big passion to promote dance, by the way. I used to be on the board of the Royal Ballet, and I'm the patron now, one of the patrons of the London School of Contemporary Dance, which is Martha Graham's school in London. And I think it's to me, it's a poster child. It's the canary in the mine shaft, this. You know, if people don't get that we have bodies, you know, then we've lost something important in our conception of humanity, I think. And dance, to me, is the most wonderful, rigorous form. I mean, to watch dancers work is really a very enlightening experience. But anyway, Nadine went to this school, and she set up a contemporary dance program. There was a lot of resistance, you can imagine, from some of the parents, like these kids, you know, guys and girls, what, they're going to dance, wear tights, are you serious? But she set up this really interesting process, I think based on Graham, and each year did a production, and it became a thing to get into the dance program. And the performances every year brought the whole community in. They were just fantastic and attracted national attention. One of the results of this has been the foundation years ago now of Europe's first black contemporary dance group. It's called Phoenix Dance. Brilliant dance company. And people from that company have since gone back to run master classes at the school. The whole point about this, though, is that she didn't go there because she heard there were these dancers there. She just went to this school and found dance in everybody. And that's the genius of great teachers. Teaching, to me, is an art form. If you know how to create the conditions for talent to flourish, then you're doing your job. And I don't believe it when people say, this is an ordinary group of kids. There's no ordinary group of kids. There's a friend of mine, wonderful guy in LA called Rafe Esquith. Mm-hmm. I went to his school recently. It's in Koreatown in LA. The kids in his class, they're mainly Asian and Latino. They're mainly non-English speakers when they go to the school. He teaches, it's an elementary school, he teaches, I think it's 9-10-year-olds mainly. Every kid who goes through his class graduates. They all go on to work or to college later on. A group of them have actually formed a foundation to support him in his own work. They all speak fluent English by the time they're done. They all play musical instruments by the time they've passed through his hands. And they're all highly motivated and energized by the experience. And he does it all by teaching them Shakespeare in Koreatown in Los Angeles. And I went to see their production this year of The Tempest. The Tempest. It was fantastic. There was a little girl, she was 9 years old, playing Ariel. And I watched her. It was just an object lesson, because it's an ensemble piece in a room a third the size of this. They do it in the classroom. There are about 40 people sitting on seats. You can get at any one time and get 40 people in to watch. There are about 40 kids performing. And they do it in an ensemble piece. They just all mill around the stage. They come on, do their thing. This little girl, I could have talked about any of them, but this little girl, she plays Ariel, speaks the verse beautifully. Actually, Ian McKellen, you know, the actor, Sir Ian McKellen, he went to see that performance there. They're called the Hobart Shakespeareans. And he said it was one of the best Shakespearean productions he'd ever seen in a middle school, you know, in an elementary middle school in LA. And he said the great thing about these children is they understand the Shakespeare, which is more than many Shakespearean actors actually do. You know? Anyway. She was jumping on stage doing her part as Ariel. She was also, they play all the instruments. There are 25 instruments played during the evening, during the performance. She also played bass guitar. They arrange all the music themselves with Rafe's help. And the music ranged from Coldplay to the second side of Abbey Road, you know, via Buddy Holly. And they're just all sitting there playing this really accomplished. They couldn't play before they met Rafe Esquith. There's a brass section, you know, a percussion section. She does all that, and she's also singing three-part harmony. And it's not taking a thing out of her. She just kind of... But they're all like that. And I noticed she was actually mouthing the words of the play when other people were on stage. And I said to him in the interval, I said, Ariel here seems to know the whole play. He said, they all do. They'd studied it for a year. And so before the second half began, he said to them, by the way, Ken here said that you all seem to know the play. You do, don't you? They said, yeah. He said, okay, so Miranda's first speech, and they just all said it. But you know, nothing would seem less probable, would it, than to teach Shakespeare to first-generation, you know, immigrant kids in Koreatown in Los Angeles. If somebody said that, you think you can't make that up. But it works. And it works because he understands that the job of a teacher is to create the conditions of growth. And that's like gardening. It's an art form. You know, gardeners know they can't make anything grow. You can't. You don't grow plants yourself. You don't stick the leaves on and paint the petals. I mean, plants grow themselves. And good gardeners know what the conditions are when that will happen. And bad ones don't, and their crops die. And good teachers know what the conditions are, and kids flourish. And these kids would never have discovered half the things they know about themselves now if they hadn't seen him. And I actually said to Rafe, this little girl's remarkable. And he said, yeah. He said, the funny thing is the teacher that she was with last year didn't like her. Mm. I said, why? He said, because she kept asking questions, so she kept sending around. Mm. You know, and I think if the Dalai Lama is prepared to say, I don't know, we should be prepared, don't you?
I agree. I agree. Before we adjourn, I'd love to ask you, when everybody reads Finding Your Element and we do the exercises and we work more closely to our passions and we're more fulfilled, what do you anticipate will happen?
Well, it's always hard to predict what will happen. I think it's very hard to predict the future. Where people are concerned, it's impossible to predict. That's the wonderful thing about human culture. It's about growth. And I don't say it will solve every problem, but you know, you have to attend to yourself if you're to be any good to anybody else. There's I fly a lot, I'm sure a lot of you do. And there's an announcement that comes on during the safety procedure on the aeroplanes about what you have to do. And it's a thing that's always struck me where it says, put your own mask on first. And I think that's right. You've got to put your own mask on first. If you don't attend to yourself and pay attention to your own growth, it's hard really to attend to other people in the way that you could. And there's a whole thing, by the way, in the book about the nature of happiness. There's a lot of stuff about this out there now in the whole field of positive psychology. And the evidence is that people, well, firstly, if you ask most people what they want from their lives, quite early on in the conversation, the word happiness will come up, either about themselves or their children or people they care for. But the indications are that people are less happy these days. I mean, you can check this research out for yourself. I reference it in the book. You know, some of the most affluent countries in the world, including America, also score low on the indices of well-being. People are 10 times more likely to suffer from depression now than they were 100 years ago, for example. Now, I know these are complicated factors to try and assess, but you know if it's true or not in the circles in which you move. I think the problem is that we've come to associate happiness with material conditions. That if we get more of this, we'll be happy. And if we know anything from our own journeys through life, there's no correlation. I mean, there are people in poverty who are happier than people who are living in the richest suburbs. All the indications of that, there's a default point. It's one of the reasons I talk about my father, you know, that people have a kind of default point where it doesn't matter what happens to you, you kind of return to that point. You know, my dad was naturally optimistic and he was devastated, we all were. But then his spirit came back to kind of where it was. But you can change that in the way you conduct yourself. But the real thing is that happiness is not a material state. If it were, the richest people would be the happiest people, the poorest would be the least happy. We know that's not true. Happiness is a spiritual state, not a material one. I mean, I'm not pleading for poverty. I'm not saying, you know, sell up, it'll all be great. But we should at least recognize the conditions of happiness, and they are within us. Not just outside, but also the indications are that we get most happy when we are connected to other people and we're serving other people. We're not just being solipsistic, where we see ourselves as part of a community. And so I don't know. Nobody could predict how it would work out. All we can say is there are optimum conditions in which people give their best and in which communities flourish. And in the post-industrial period and during the industrial period, we created poor conditions in a lot of communities. We created poor conditions in education. If we improve them, we'll get a better result. And I think that's at least worth investing in.
Thank you. Our enormous thanks to Sir Ken Robinson for visiting us in San Francisco this evening. I cannot wait to have a world that's more influenced by your ideas. So I'm Nineveh Caligari, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in now, is adjourned.
Thank you very much.